This talk is being given on October 22nd, 2015, to the Ag Auto Ethanol Working Group in Southfield, Michigan. It's entitled Mid-Level Ethanol Blends. Can we produce enough fuel feedstocks? And my answer is yes, due to surplus feed grain capacity of the three main world exporters. I want to make a general disclaimer to start off with. PRX does not do paid white papers to advocate for or against government policy. For our clients, of course, we offer commercial perspectives on the future that may well be dependent on government policies and using methods we deem to be reasonable, such as the present calculation or snapshot. And our studies are not intended for general academic peer review, just commercial reasonableness. So I will cover, in trying to answer this question about the state of how much corn there is in 2030, by looking at world grain and oilseed production now with its surplus regions, the U.S. corn yield trend to 2030 using the USDA baseline, and the U.S. gasoline volume that's likely in 2030 based on DOE's annual energy outlook of 2015, then I'll make this simplified calculation of how much ethanol there will be and whether there'll be a corn deficit or surplus in 2030. And then I got three footnotes on crude oil and corn market price, advanced biofuels, and then the overall drivers of U.S. corn efficiency gains. So page two is the first slide of numbers from current official USDA data. We need to keep in mind that USDA has a vast set of official data on world and U.S. grains. And here's a pie chart of world total grains and oilseed production. The latest full finished year is 2014-15. And there were about 3 billion tons, 3017 million metric tons. It's important to break them up by the type of grain. You see wheat and a little bit of rye, 740 million tons, rice 479 million tons. So at least 40% of the total here is what's meant by world food, which is mainly wheat and rice, and it's not widely used as fuel. On the left, shaded more green for the sake of being able to use a little bit of it, are the oil seeds, with soybeans as the largest, and then rapeseed, sunflower seed, etc. And then the two classes of feed grains, namely corn and then all others, which would be sorghum and barley and so on. So world the oil seeds provide protein, and they also provide oil for food. Okay, and the feed grains is what you feed to animals to get meat. And if this is in surplus, then the feed grains, especially corn, can be used for fuel without necessarily dramatically or even at all affecting the food grains on the right. Okay, page three. When we look a little bit more closely at the world total grains and oilseed by origin, here's what we find. In the number table at the left, there's your 3017 million metric tons of total grains and oilseed production in 14-15. Now, of that 3,017, 1182, or 39%, is in the three major export hubs, the U.S., Canada, Brazil, Argentina, and the Russian Black Sea. The remainder, 1835, or 61% of the production, is in the rest of the world. All right, well, opposite that, on the right, I show you world population of 7244 billion people, and the export hubs have only 11% of the world's population. So in other words, the pie chart up on top shows you that here's the oddity of the way geography and the quality of land and farmland is makes the world. 11% of the world's population has 39% of the total world grain and oilseed production. So in other words, they're embarrassed by how much, they can't eat how much they produce. they're in surplus. The rest of the world, 89%, do not have enough money for grain and oilseed imports, particularly for feed as meat. They can't afford it, okay? So that's the problem. That's why a surplus, particularly of feed grains, develops. Page 4, here's a map that indicates the three main regions. The U.S. and Canada with 5% of the world's population and 22% of the production. The Black Sea, 3 and 7. Brazil, Argentina, 3 and 10. So unless the rest of the world, the 89% of the population, has money to buy meat, or unless the surpluses are used for fuel, then the surpluses just build up and send the price down until people stop planting. Page 5 is the chart of production over time, with the world in blue, the rest of the world, excluding the exporters, at 89% of the population, going up in a steady fashion, and the red are the three export hubs. So in the last 10 years, the reaction of the three major grain export hubs to better paying demand for China soybeans and the U.S. corn ethanol was a production increase of 368 million tons of grains and oilseeds, about 14 billion bushels increase in one decade, okay? All right, now we can see that perhaps better on page 6. These start to be yield lines, okay? So again, I've separated the export hubs with 34%. Now I'm looking just at corn now, okay? Three export hubs with 34% of the world corn area, and then the rest of the world with 66% of the corn area, but again, 89% of the population. The yield lines are headed steadily up. These are official USDA numbers. Obviously, the export hubs have more variability in their climate and weather, but you can see that the variability is not increasing, and the variability of the rest of the world is not increasing either. These are steady linear trends, and they're diverging. The exportable corn surplus grows unless the world has more money for meat and or other uses such as corn for fuel. All right, page 7, let's zero in now on the three exporting regions. The U.S. and Canada has the highest yields. What I want to point out about the FSU 12, the Black Sea, and Brazil and Argentina is you can see that with the big price increase after China enters the world economy, okay, in 2000, about 2000 or 2003 or 4, somewhere in there, their yields jump up. In other words, they saw this higher price for all grains and they went after it. In our case, it didn't change that much. The average yield trend to fit that curve would show that the U.S. Canada would have in 2030 a yield of 189 bushels per acre of corn. All right, I want to refine that a little bit more on page 8 and look at the USDA baseline team. They make their own 10-year forecast starting. They're working on next year's right now, and we'll release it sometime in December. But the last one we have shows that, I show the last 6 or 7 here. They're always straight line trends, okay, and they go up about 2 bushels per acre per year. That's what they call the technological trend growth, okay? They always assume normal weather. Now, if you extrapolate their trends on out to 2030, they would be at 197.3. In our PRX commercial case, we like to stretch the future out with the same sort of deviations as we've had in the past. And we'd be at 191.8. So we're saying, let's split the difference here for this snapshot at 195. The genetic potential yield is more than double this, as shown by NCGA corn contest winners. And I must mention, sort of by the way, what about climate change? Well, the worst recent drought was 2012, and the National Oceanic Atmospheric Administration has a large report saying that this was a meteorological flash drought with no external forcing, such as El Niño, La Niña, or GHG emissions. But what about climate change? Okay, because look, on page 9, the USDA has a climate change office right under the chief economist. And they would be pleased to go ahead and follow the president's directive that, everything's going to get hotter and the crops will suffer. Except they really, their hands are tied because the United Nations models, when you take them down to a regional level, like the Corn Belt. So what I show here is the actual reported temperature of the 12 Corn Belt states since 1900. And it shows a very, very slight increase, okay, with lots of variability. But when you go to the models, not only do they not match, they don't match up to the degree of volatility, which is a key characteristic of markets here, all right? But they show the temperature rising 2.4 times faster than the observed temperatures. So the economists, who are scientists too, or they consider themselves scientists, the baseline team, really are unwilling to apply this regional model and advise the president and Congress that, yeah, you can expect, lower yields because of climate change. Okay, now, so we'll use the 195 for 2030. What about how much gasoline will we use? Okay, page 10 is the latest full annual energy outlook, and quite obviously it was put out last December, December 14, before the break in crude oil prices. And since that time, as we can see from the short-term energy outlook through 2015, we're using a lot more gasoline because, we drive more with cheap gas. But I don't see, I'm willing to make a personal prediction, or the PRX is willing to make a team projection of how much gasoline will actually be used. But I don't see a way to not use the AEO forecast here. Now, this reduction, this reduction from 135 billion gallons down to 110, 25 billion gallons, in the report, AEO says that the reduction will be due to increasingly stringent fuel economy standards for gasoline in the transportation sector. But they don't say how, or at least I couldn't find it. They don't say whether it's better engines only or a greater mix of small cars, or could it be changing both engines and fuel mix to high octane or what? So, we're just left to think what we want to think. So, I for the sake of doing a snapshot on page 11, I think we have to adopt these target numbers from the AEO 2015. Now, there will be another one soon enough, and presumably they'll be a bit higher. I don't know. Our own commercial idea that until we see, in other words, here's our, we're willing to believe that mid-level blends and high-octane engines are a real possibility, but it requires quite a policy jump. You have to have EPA willing to regulate fuel and engines at the same time. And so until we can see that that's more likely, perhaps as a result of this working group or whatever, we've got our own trend line up above. What we're used for this exercise is 130 billion gallons in 2020, 121 in 2025, and 113.5 in 2030. Okay, so now just to get acquainted with the corn supply-demand table, because I'm not going to do the whole thing. The supply-demand table for U.S. corn looks like you have a carry-in, you plant a certain amount of acres. The record is 97 million acres. This year, a yield of 168. That would be 195, we think, in 2030. And we get a production of 13,585. And so the question is, can we produce enough for a scenario in 2030 that has 70% E25? Well, on the demand side, the feed and residual use is flat. Exports are flat due to the growth of our competitors in the Black Sea and Brazil and Argentina, and due to the fact that China has plenty of corn, certainly right now, and has vowed not to become dependent on the U.S. For corn, okay? A little bit of soybeans, yeah, but not corn. That goes against their politics, and we have embargoed. So, you can't. That's their position. So if they have to get more corn, it won't be from us. It'll be from our competitors. So could some of that pass on? Yeah, well, but I don't think that much. So very slight growth in industrial non-fuel. So all we've got to focus on is this fuel ethanol grind, which at the moment is 52.24 for 14.5 billion gallons. And we got to calculate how much ethanol we're going to need to hit ETH and how much corn that will require. Okay, so I'm going to simplify it down to just calculating that. So here's the calculation. First part of the calculation. There are the numbers up above. 130 billion gallons in 2020, 121, 957, 113, 542, and 2030. And so 2% of that is E0, and we reduce the part that's E10 from 93 down to 28, and we increase the E25 from 5% in 2020 up to 70%. And so that gives you a calculation then of the domestic, the conventional ethanol production then in 2030 will be about 24,363, or an increase of 10 billion gallons roughly. Increase of 10 billion gallons, and that needs to come from conventional. I've got a line up there for cellulosic, and I see it only going to 350. So I'll defend that later. And 24,363 would be the conventional ethanol production. Now let's add the rest of the calculations, because we know that the corn, that the ethanol yield from corn per bushel in line 16 here is going up, 2.8 now. Let's say it goes up 0.02, it goes to 2.94, and so we'd have to get 24 divided by 2.94 is 8277 is the corn milo ethanol production grind. Now, some of that is fed back to cattle, so we got to subtract that. So you got to calculate the DDG production, which I show you in lines 19 through 24. So there's 1131 million bushels corn, whole corn equivalent, that's fed as part of domestic consumption. So we really only need 7146 new corn, because we don't, we don't have to produce that corn to feed animals. It comes out of the DDG. So 7146, the difference between 2030 and 2015 is an increase of 28, almost 3 billion bushels. Now, how much corn will there be? Well, if we, lines 28 through 30 are just my estimates of the DDG exports, which I take, there's 997 million bushels that would be available if we didn't export any of that. It'd get fed back to our cows too, okay? But I'm going to ship that offshore. So there's, that's an ambitious number for DDG exports. So, I just want to show you that I'm, not exaggerating. If we take the corn area up to from 90 to 94 and we use the 195, we get a yield of 1627, which is an increase of 3136 compared to the 2881. And we still, supplying E25 at 70% leaves us with an annual corn surplus growing to 250 million bushels. So yes, there's plenty of corn. Now, my footnote one is about corn and soybean market prices. And I think you have to realize these things. I know you don't think it's important, in the auto industry, but it's terribly important to know what happened from 2007 to 2013. We had a huge global commodity super cycle price, and that's what drove up the price and the returns of corn and soybeans in the Corn Belt. It wasn't corn fuel use played a very supporting role, and so did imports of soybeans by China. But what we do on page 16 is we use a regression model for corn price, whose main component is crude oil price. And it's not because corn is used as a fuel. It wasn't back in the 70s. Crude oil price, we think, is a proxy for the interest of banks and everybody else to invest in the commodity sector. And if people are very bullish about this, it drives up crude oil price doesn't follow, you know, detailed fundamentals of supply and demand either. It depends on the sentiment of investors and speculators. And so we have a ridiculous R squared on corn and soybeans of 0.92 and 0.95. And so we get a slightly higher price in the future, depending on how we project crude oil price. So on page 17, here is our crude oil price prediction. It's right in between DOE's lowest and their reference case. So we don't have, you know, we have crude oil price, you know, eventually making it back up to between $70 and $80 per barrel, which would give us, you know, a corn price in the $4.50 range. And what's important, I think, to investors in this sector is the ratio of crude oil price to corn. I mean, there are refiners that are that have what you call a play on ethanol. In other words, their play is that corn price over the long term will stay cheaper than crude oil price. Okay? So it's the ratio that they're looking at. If we use our crude oil forecast of going back up to 70 and we get a corn price in the 450, then the ratio down at the bottom is favorable to the ethanol business. And that's generally what we're saying to investors, okay? That yes, corn price, you know, is low because it's in surplus, and the lower it goes, the more will be exported. We have this 15 billion gallon dry mill industry capable of exporting ethanol if the price of crude oil is right, okay? Or if you get people to understand that the octane value is substantial. Footnote two, what about advanced ethanol, particularly from corn stover? Here's another snapshot that we did in a recent year, showing the you know, the dozen and a half highest producing, highest yield areas of corn, districts of corn, and if you had one ethanol project per district, you know, you could conceive of getting like 600 million gallons out of that with one mill in every, you know, group of 9 or 10 counties. We know that you know, that companies just recently, this month, pledged 1,200 million gallons by 2025, and maybe they're right. Okay, if they're right about that, then this 1,200 million gallons of stover ethanol would mean that our whole corn surplus would be double what we already calculated, or at least 500 million bushels per year. Okay, another source of advanced fuel on page 20 is Brazil, and the population to sugarcane production ratio is even more ridiculous. 3% of the world's population produce 41% of the sugarcane. Okay, and that's their blessing and that's their problem. So they have E27, and if their economy is in great shape, their driving keeps increasing, and they can hardly keep up with that with the sugar. They can't increase the sugarcane acreage in the mills unless the price of world sugar goes up. But it too is down because of this commodity price super cycle. So it could be that our government, you know, raises the advanced biofuel requirement and causes sugar ethanol to come up here from Brazil. And that can happen. Of course, if they don't have enough ethanol themselves, we'll have to ship corn ethanol back down there to make up for it. Finally, I just want to end on the note that you know, this yield gain pattern, our advantage in the United States is this input industry that I show at the bottom. Seeds, fertilizer, chemicals, machinery, good land, okay, and it has a price. And that the black line is the gross revenue over these input costs. And look, the input industry has become a $90 billion industry. That's our real asset that Brazil and the Black Sea doesn't have, particularly in seeds. They'll have to get it from us. And so you can't get these yield gains unless the overall financial health of the corn soybean sector is in good condition. So in other words, you've got to have a reasonable price of corn before any of this will take place, and that's my message for today.